Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife. I'm Dave Marr. I'm a comedian who survived a coma. And this is my podcast where I talk to artists and organizers about death and art and politics, an event that defines their lives. And in this episode, the second episode of the week, the third week of two episode weeks in the last couple months, I talked to two people about the book they edited. Hello again, Sean O'Brien. And hello again, after a while, Madeline Lane McKinley.
Hello. Hey. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, delighted.
The book is, The Return of the 90s, A Cultural History of the Present, right?
You got it.
Okay, cool. Before we get started, this show is supported by listeners like you at Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thisisyourafterlife. For $5 a month, you get the premium feed. Not every week is a two-episode week, folks. Mostly it's one episode, and then you got to wait 2 weeks, but you don't if you're on the Patreon. Also, thank you to the producers who support for $15 a month, Katie Llewellyn, Fred Fidowa, Shubha Singh, G. Debo, and Doc Lobster, M.D. So, Madeline, you, I having like spent time editing Sean's episode and reading the book, mm-hmm. I feel like Sean and I are like in conversation, and I need you to like jump on board already.
Okay.
Sean, okay. What's your like, because it's been just long enough since we talked that I did actually have to like remind myself of the things. I was like, Sean was very patient, explained kind of all of Marxism to me, I think, in like
oh, good.
20 minutes. I knew that you would not really have much interest in doing that, Madeline. So I was like, Sean, I need you to like give me the 101 on like, as someone who should have graduated college with a sense of what Marxism is and did not. Yeah, Sean was obliging in that way.
That's what I'm here for. I'm here for Marx 101 and yeah, obliging levels of patience with everyone.
Marx 101, yeah. Never get more advanced with Marx than that. Just have to keep re-explaining the same fucking commodity.
That's literally my shtick, is to do Marx 101 over and over again, actually.
Yeah.
It is,
I do it in multiple venues, in multiple media formats. You can read it, you can watch it, you can listen to it. I might appear live at your local event and talk to you about it.
Not a Marx related event, just like a random ribbon cutting ceremony, and you're there in the corner talking about
Comic-Con.
I would love to see the 90s infomercial version of that Marx 101, you know.
Yeah, you have to be careful suggesting things now, because what if somebody out there makes an AI version of it?
Oh,
and
God.
Suddenly, right? So
I think
you can't actually suggest things anymore.
Oh,
well, what are the hits? In a 90s infomercial, it would be like listing the hits. So it would be like, what?
It'll be all the mature work, the works of this mature critique, right? The Grundrisse, Capital, Volume 1, 2, and 3.
So you would be actually like the titles of the books, not like concepts. I was thinking like concept hits. Like,
oh, that's richer media. I like it better. Yeah.
Okay.
However, mm-hmm. I would probably reach for the titles just because that's one of the ways that people tend to distinguish a body of work from within a larger body of work. Mm-hmm. When they want to get serious
mm-hmm.
about stuff. Yeah. Concepts, though. You could do concepts.
You could do concepts. The 90s infomercial might also just be about how the object, the physical object of the books themselves could be useful to sit on, to like, as like a placemat, potentially.
Yeah. Yeah. They're so square.
Step stool.
And I don't know that they would work as a placemat. You could arrange
no, you're
them
right.
into, yeah.
I mean, feel like some people have
placemat.
Eaten off
it's
their...
just a precarious... of
yeah right.
Well, there's this thing that I was long before people were talking about performative male reading or whatever, mm-hmm. but this kind of social media phenomenon that I've as so long as there's been social media, there have been Marxist dudes showing how fucked up their the spines of their marks
spine
were,
check.
Right?
The That's spine what I was check, gonna say.
Right?
Yeah.
Also a margin check, right? There's all sorts of competitions, dick measuring kinds of behaviors. But you could have an infomercial about how to dirty your marks without having to read any of it.
Superb. Oh my fuck, that's actually a really
good
one. To
wear down.
Yeah. That's a 90s thing, man, that people used to do in the town where I lived was like,
oh, really?
Go and buy a pair of chucks and like
throw
them in front of a car so that they would get dusted up, and then they could look legit because they're too clean and too new.
Yeah, you're talking about like pre-distressed marks books, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Acid
actually,
washed
something here.
Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels readers.
Yes.
Well, before we get into the book, it made me wonder what, like, if there's any pop culture things, doesn't even have to be related to the 90s, but things that you're obsessed with, like, right in this moment, exactly right now. For me, it would be I've been into NBA basketball a lot over the past couple months.
Oh.
Gotten really into the new Real Housewives franchise, Rhode Island, cooking competition shows, especially the like Guy Fieri vein of cooking competition shows. Are there ones that you have now that are maybe even that you feel the felt the freedom to get into with the book being done?
Like that aren't research related, just stuff I want to do.
Yeah.
No.
I'm totally obsessed with the show.
Sorry.
I love that. I appreciate that.
No, I'll think about it.
No, that's good. It doesn't to be a... Yeah, did you have one, Sean?
When you said no, I was like, okay, I'm going to step in quick. Yes, I'm totally obsessed with this show that's shot here in Nova Scotia called From. It's ridiculous. It's sort of like, it's a psychological, science fiction-y, supernatural horror thriller set. The set is not far from where I am now in Halifax, in Nova Scotia. It stars this guy called Harold Perrineau, or he's one of the main actors who also, there's a 90s connection. He plays Boyd. Who is the kind of like sort of pseudo sheriff of this, of Fromville. Fromville is a place that you accidentally end up. You're just driving and suddenly you come upon this like tree that is falling across the street. You have to stop. There are crows circling overhead. You turn around, you go back and you drive into this kind of like strange, weird, eerie, uncanny looking small town with a diner and an outdoor pool with a car tipped over into it. And you're like, this is bizarre. And you kind of, because you know, you get the spookies, you keep going. And even though you keep going straight, you come back through it. And eventually you stop and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, there's all kinds of other stuff going on. It kind of has a Lost feeling, which is not a show I love. Insofar as I'm pretty sure they're making it up as they go along. And rather than answering questions, they just add more and more questions. But he was the narrator of the show Oz, an early HBO, you know, this like experimental prison film, right? Where he would introduce each episode at the beginning and then kind of close it off with his kind of like wise kind of parable, kind of wisdom kind of moment. And I love that show Oz. And anyway, I saw him at the local fried chicken place when I was in the lineup. He was there. And he was getting some chicken and I was like super starstruck and just like, I don't know. That's so anyway, the new,
so
there's a new season
the
out at the moment. Yeah. There's a new, the fourth season is out at the moment and I'm eating it up and they're doing this sort of staggered release episode a week thing. That, you know, maybe got used to not having to wait for episodes. So yeah, it's my current cultural kind of fixation.
That's your thing.
Yeah. Oz has not
trying to solve the puzzle of
life in the same way that so many of those HBO shows had, you know?
I know. Maybe. I never watched Oz. So I feel kind of bad.
But I knew about it.
It's always
it.
Been, felt like kind of eating my vegetables or something.
Oh, okay.
You know, in terms of shows.
Yeah.
I skipped whatever I was meant to be doing to stay at home and watch it.
Oh, really?
Do you think it holds
up?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I have distinct memories. Of... It's a good question. I haven't watched it since way back.
Okay, okay. But you don't have any memories of like, yeah, they
I should
did
return to
use
it.
The F slur like a lot. Like, that's the kind of stuff where I'm like, I can imagine like,
right.
things like that yeah. being part of it or something.
But there was a lot of gay sex on it. That's what I knew.
Yeah,
yeah.
Same.
I think it was actually quite a groundbreaking show in certain ways. And it also like, but my lasting takeaway is that it wants to kind of critically explore the limits of being, of taking a kind of liberal humanist approach to prison reform. So that would be like, you know,
well,
yes, it stands up, right? Like
yeah.
mm-hmm.
prisons are not reformable. Like for all your good intentions, you can't just make this thing a bit nicer or like make, you know what I mean? But maybe there's all kinds of horrid shit going on. I expect it probably is.
I'll probably watch it. I've run out of shows like that, that are like my golden age, like HBO shows, you know?
Right.
Was and that then, a reel? Yeah, you'll probably watch it? Because it sounded like the least.
Yeah, I probably, will.
Okay. Oh. Okay.
I'm not just completely facetious.
No. I mean, I would
probably
like,
will at some point.
Maybe
I'll probably
projecting
get around
I
to
probably
it.
Will not. Watch it. Although you did make it sound more yeah. compelling, Sean, the like non-reformable aspect of it.
Yeah.
The other well, thing it's is not that very it's many episodes. It's like two seasons or something like that. It was very okay. short-lived, right? And it was
yeah.
it came out. It started
it
right before the
it
Sopranos.
Six.
Oh
seasons.
Jesus! All right. Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. Look at me, cultural historian here.
and there are loads of people. Loads of people in it who you'll see elsewhere. People from The Wire are on it.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
Wasn't Hal Sparks on it? The guy who was in those, he hosted like Blind Date and stuff like that. Do you
oh,
know what
yeah.
talking about?
Gosh, I can't
I
remember.
Don't know.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you.
Sean, what we're really running up into right now is the cul-de-sac created not by the Oz answer, but by... Madeline's answer of
I'll tell you what I
I have other things I'm curious about with the book, but you can tell me if there really is something, but I don't want you to make something up. I like that you felt the freedom.
I'm not
to
making
say,
it up, but I'm not, it's okay. Right now I'm watching something that I don't think is very good. And which is that dumb TV show Rivals.
Oh wait, the Ryan Murphy thing?
No.
Rivals.
Although I will watch Ryan Murphy's show if it's a 90s period piece show, because it hits, you know, the correct part of my algorithm. It's like a British period thing. It's set in the 80s, and it's about there's a rivalry, there's a war for like a programming on the BBC, and there's a lot of really stupid like sex, and yeah, it's just not very good. It's just a lot of people are talking about it around me, so it's something I'll pop on when I'm at the, you know, at the gym. I'm like, I guess I'll watch this dumb show.
Love it.
One of the things I love about Madeline is she doesn't listen to stuff at the gym, she watches stuff at the gym. Like,
I do listen to stuff too.
Sure, but I mean, you also next level it by literally watching shows at the gym.
Oh yeah.
I'm not even quite sure how to conceptualize the practicalities of that yet, so I'm quite impressed
oh
that.
Thank you. Yeah, I definitely, that's a really important part of my exercise regimen.
Is
having a treadmill show, as I describe it.
I like imagining
they can't
Sean
be very good
can't
they
picture
have to
it.
Just be
no go ahead they have to be
I'll show you. Oh, no, they just they have to be kind of trashy. They have to have momentum, right? Because they're a treadmill show.
Yeah.
So I'll watch a thriller. I'll watch mysteries. Those are great. Anything with some suspense. But this is just kind of like trashy melodrama that also kind of does the trick for me.
Yeah.
But it's something I would never watch otherwise. Like, I would never watch this show unless I was kind of held hostage by an elliptical machine. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, which is kind of like what the gym is Going to the gym is like, right, being held hostage by some other version of yourself that you fucking hate.
I know.
But also, I don't think I quite realize that they're entirely restricted to the treadmill. I kind of envisioned you like going to other elements of the gym and like continuing to watch somehow while you like
did
legs or whatever.
No, that would be pretty cool.
Yeah. That's why I was imagining Sean having trouble conceptualizing it, because I like imagining Sean, you as like not only a gym bro, but the kind of gym bro who is like so loud, he has to clank his weights down and you're so in it. You're like, I don't know how you can watch anything. I mean, it would like, it completely clashes with my view of you as a person, but I would love if that were like a facet of you that just like, I had no idea of. You're like, I'm too in it at the gym. I'm like a raging bull.
Yeah, you're just too in it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the thing, I think the reason I wanted to ask about a current fixation is because the book is like, it's fun. Mm. And I had this with you too, Sean, like fun imagining you all writing about these things, thinking about these things, getting into things. I remember Sean telling you how excited I was for you. I could tell your excitement upon like discovering the treasure trove of Wired, you know, rapturous future prediction articles. And so it's like, it feels exciting in that way. And I'm curious I'm genuinely interested in this. I know some people are very bored at creative process talk, but I want to know, you two are editing this. You didn't write every chapter. Is one of you a first pass writer and another is an editor? Are you just splitting up sections? Are you having, say you're writing the introduction, is that like multiple sessions of just together figuring out sentence by sentence? What is the actual workflow of editing this book look like for you?
I love this question. That's great. Okay.
Thank you.
Well, one thing is that, of course. We were located 8 hours apart, time zone wise, in doing most of the book. You know, you spend summers in Nova Scotia, it's 4 hours, but we always have a significant time difference. So something that I always enjoyed is we'd have these long ass Zoom sessions where I'd get on and it would be dark outside and I'd be haggard as fuck, kind of like this morning, and I'd have my coffee, but Sean would have like had a full day. And then he's like, eventually he's having his Guinness and I'm having my, you know, fourth cup of coffee. And I don't know, we're just operating on these different temporal registers. And I enjoyed that a lot because I think, you do need somebody to do a first pass and a second pass. I think we like changed between those a lot, but there's also just like, you need to like be thinking about the book from all these different angles and things like that. So I really enjoyed having a collaborator because, you would just be able to articulate what we were doing in ways that clarified what I was doing for me. That was interesting. We did different passes, and it was interesting writing together. I'm writing a book with somebody new now, who I've never written anything with. We're kind of trying to figure out our process. And I've been thinking a lot about like, we just wrote the introduction together, but it was one of the best experiences I've had of writing with somebody. I feel like we each took sections and you could probably assume which one is ours, but then we had our hands on each other's sentences enough that there was a certain point where it's like, it really felt like everything was both of ours. But that took a lot of, how many times did we go through it? I mean,
the introduction.
Easily a dozen, thorough readings.
Definitely. Sort of swapping places, was kind of part of the process, I suppose. So yeah, you're right, Dave, that obviously, right, logistically, it like makes sense to kind of designate, okay, you're going to do you're going to take this half of the stack of contributions, and I'm going to take this half, and you're going to be first lead on kind of editing that half, and I'm going to, and then we're going to swap. But then when they come in next time, we're going to swap stacks, and I'm going to take the other batch and go first time with that. And so, like, always trying to kind of like bounce it out. And that similar kind of process on a maybe a more immediate scale with the introduction, where we're kind of writing it together and really genuinely writing it together, but still kind of separating out sections, kind of producing those sections, merging them, swapping them together, so swapping them around, and then just reworking them over and over and over again, until and kind of going in and correcting or expanding or revising sections of one another's writing. Just like actually a really nice thing to do with, like, you know, comrades, friends, people who's thinking you really respect and enjoy, you know. And that's like part of it was like just the kind of how enjoyable the process was. Because it has to be, I don't know, it would be so shit to do such a large project. It's not the biggest project I've ever done, but it's definitely up there in terms of like logistics and organizing and whatever, if you don't actually just like literally enjoy it and enjoy working together and all that. Yeah, that makes such a massive difference.
Yeah, there's a lot of joking around. But honestly, there are these sessions on Zoom that would go on for 8 or 9 hours. I'd be looking, and we're both wearing like hoods, and we look kind of like
sounds very
like
grad
possums or something
coded.
Like that. Like I don't know. We would get to a point where, you know, but I don't know. It's funny. We're going to hang out with each other next week, but the last time I saw Sean, we didn't even have a book contract. That was when I met you, Dave, in Chicago, in
at the conference where you guys first did the panel, right?
Yeah, that was 3 years, more than 3 years ago. But I spent I spend sometimes, you know, 15 hours a week with Sean on the computer. So it's a weird relationship that we have in some ways.
That's very true. Yeah, it's very true. And I mean, like, because of the timing, you know, like I get home from teaching or whatever, jump on Zoom, and then I'd be like, damn, it's been like 4 hours. I haven't eaten anything. Like, I'm going to, you know, so often it was a practical thing. Like, Madeline would be like, you know, I have to go do this thing, or I've got to eat dinner. And that's like, otherwise we would just kind of work forever. And it was always like more that we could be doing, but somehow we also never fell behind, which is weird. I just expected at some point to be like, okay, we're actually fucked. We need like 6 more months. And that just never happened. So that's also down to our contributors who were like good at getting things back to us and stuff. But
it's true. Yeah. It's true.
And did you get the chapters in the book? Did you start with list of contributors and they provided whatever they wanted to write about? Or were you like, there's some stuff that we gotta... You know, we gotta
kind of
have
a
Lisa Frank chapter or whatever. You know.
I know. Well, inevitably with a book like this, people are going to be like, is there a chapter on blank? Is there a chapter? Right, no, there isn't. You know, probably
like, no, write
not
your own book,
you know,
dumbass.
But
I'm saying that for you guys.
Yeah,
you guys
well,
don't have
you
to
know,
say that. Hey guys, get the
thank you.
Get
thank
a
you.
Fucking
I mean, maybe we could have
shit.
A volume too. I don't want to, you know.
Yeah. Right.
This is becoming a soundbite. I heard this thing. Maybe we'll have a volume two. Okay. This is a good. It's a good like off ramp for people to be like, yeah, you know, maybe
thank
we'll
you.
Have a volume two. Hey, I'm definitely gonna watch it. It's only 2 seasons, right? That's
maybe.
Your. That's the version. No,
well,
but, yeah.
we organized this seminar at that conference ACLA. And a lot of
literature.
our contributors were, yes, a lot of them were participating in that.
Okay.
And some of them wrote totally different things, but some of them didn't. So we kind of knew a few of the things that were going to be in there. And then we started trying to find, you know, like I really wanted something on New Queer Cinema. I sought out my, you know, my friend Phil, actually, who was on our podcast once, Dave, to write a chapter on that with his friend Octavio. I don't know. There were just like certain regions that we wanted to hit, but we weren't that specific. Like, people have asked us about Beanie Babies. And it's like, no, we don't have a Beanie Baby chapter, but we have an American Doll chapter. We have something kind of in that region that helps you kind of think about that phenomenon, right? Maybe it's not that specifically, but like, I think it will help you, you know.
Yeah. We don't have a grunge chapter, but we have a chapter about Seattle and radical politics and the kind of movement of the anti-globalization movement and so on. So like, you know, there's these ways of thinking about some of the more obvious, because one of the things we didn't want to do with the book is just produce like yet another kind of set of obvious kind of examples of 90s cultural history, which are just so explicitly rooted in nostalgia. Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is so funny to like have made this book, you know, like thinking of this period of time, resisting even the idea of conceiving of periods of time, and then have someone's response be like, hey, so remember I'm trying to think of another like example of like my favorite. Remember slap bracelets or whatever the fuck thing they're, you know, like, it's like, it's not really a nostalgia project.
I mean, and there were critical kind of regions that didn't get covered that we thought about or might have been interested. Personally, like, I was kind of like keen to have something on Cool Britannia, you know, and the kind of Tony Blair, Labour, Blue Labour, New Labour, Labour 2.0, whatever kind of third way neoliberalism kind of moment in the UK, Spice Girls, you know, the like Blur Oasis rivalry or whatever. I don't know, whatever. Like, it's not that I wanted someone to write on Wonderwall. It's that I wanted someone to write on third way neoliberalism through this, like, you know what I mean? And we do have stuff on third way neoliberalism for sure. But
and Oasis comes up.
Yeah, and Oasis comes up. Like, you can't really, I mean, they provide some of the kind of cultural scaffolding for the conceit of the project, right? But there were other things that we felt we definitely needed, so we went and sought those out and like looked and looked more. Like, if we couldn't find them right away, we kept looking and found them. So it was a real balance between, you know, things and other things that just people pitched that we were like, wow, I hadn't thought of that. That sounds like a great, like the American Girl Doll essay, right, is one of my favorites in it. You know, I didn't even know what an American Girl Doll was.
Oh, it's a whole insane phenomenon. Yeah.
No, it's fascinating. I learned a lot about the 90s in doing this project. And, you know, I hadn't really watched any of Friends. You know, that was one of my, in the 90s, I was like, I will not.
Yeah.
I won't.
No Friends.
Yeah, basically. But we got a really interesting chapter from Ali Ansari about watching Friends in syndication years later, context of Mumbai. Right. She writes a little bit about that too, but in her childhood of it being like syndicated, exported to Mumbai and places like this, and what this kind of, she calls it a cultural jet lag that she experienced. So I was like, this is actually a really fascinating way for me to encounter Friends. And then as she was writing it, I ended up watching a few episodes of Friends. I was like, I guess I'll have to do this. I guess I have to engage with this from this kind of scholarly
vantage. And was it different?
But I like that it forced me to do that. I wasn't watching it for the same reasons, right? Like, I remember the times when I was a kid and watching it and being like, oh my God, the show is telling me I must be anorexic. And like, you know, like it was like just forcing this toxic shit down my throat, right? And like, you have to be a Rachel or a whoever the other, Monica. You have to be one of those. But it was also, it was one of those things that was so pervasive. I knew all the names of the characters and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
There was no way not to, right? But it was some, I was trying to kind of hold a line. I'm not gonna go there. I loved Seinfeld, but anyway, so it was interesting to be reading and looking at this stuff, and then also through this perspective that estranged my own, you know, childhood personal experience. I found that actually kind of cathartic in some way too. But it's also just fascinating to see. Yeah, Shama Rangwala has a great chapter on Star Trek, specifically Star Trek Deep Space Nine. But I was really appreciate, you know, as somebody who grew up in a Star Trek household, appreciating the effort she made to kind of construct this long durée of the franchise, and that also to kind of think about these different moments and the political tendencies of the different series. Yeah, I don't know. There was something like really pleasurable about going back over this familiar territory in some way. I don't know if you felt that way, Sean, but
yeah, and rediscovering it anew, or sort of like seeing it with fresh eyes, which was kind of the ethos of the project all along, right? Was never really just to simply kind of retread this ground for the sake of kind of, you know, a kind of self-indulgent kind of, oh, remember what the 90s were like. I really missed that. But we were always trying to keep that kind of cultural tendency, which was one of the initial things we noticed that prompted our interest in this project in the first place, right? Like, why are so many people so obsessed with the 90s culturally, particularly in its cultural forms, right? Like, and not just its forms of media, but like dress, fashion, like kind of social trends, lingo, slang, 90s slang.
We noticed this a lot as college teachers too, right? There was a certain point where
college teachers trying to figure out what are our students doing, you know, in a great way.
Why are students bringing this stuff? Yeah. Like, what are they bringing in from high school, right? I teach first and second year classes too. So that's also kind of interesting because they're still kind of like, you know, there's residue of like whatever their hometown was or things like that. But there was this like decisive moment where we talked about, this was years before the project, but we're like, God, everyone's dressing like Friends and talking, you know, and they weren't even alive and they don't even really seem to know the historical referent of it, you know, which isn't to like dismiss it. But I also had a conversation with a student about Y2K and they like didn't know that it was an event. They thought it was just a fashion aesthetic. And I think, you know, I don't mean to criticize. I'm just like, this is how younger people are encountering the 90s through these two cultural forms predominantly that we found really striking. We wanted to understand.
Yeah. And we also then recognized a kind of like second move that was occurring, which was that people were also beginning to notice people noticing it and starting to either from like an economic point of view, kind of capitalize on it. Urban Outfitters selling like Nirvana sweaters and stuff like this, right? But also people beginning to maybe write books about the 90s. But I mean, there are some good ones out there. There are some other ones out there.
Rank them.
But I like John Gans's When the Clock Broke. But,
No, I'm kidding. Go ahead. Keep going.
Anyway, there's we didn't feel that we felt that there was a predominant tendency to want to either just simply narrate the history of the decade or speak explicitly about the nostalgic content of contemporary fixations with the 90s. Mm-hmm. And what we really felt was missing from the conversation, particularly at a broad level, and thinking in the way we tried to do in the project, and this is reflected in its kind of table of contents, is expansively, without being completist, was to think about how the 90s kind of produced our own historical moment. So hence the subtitle, right? The Cultural History of the Present.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the phrase I pulled out from page 7 is of the introduction. You say, in telling the story of a return to the 90s, we are ultimately seeking to understand our own historical moment. And then I wrote a question that you then immediately, before reading the next couple sentences, I wrote a question without realizing that you answered my question in those next couple sentences.
Nice.
Which is
transitional sentences.
You know, what do you understand about the current moment? And the things that I found, and tell me if I'm leaving anything out, you found in our current moment a longing for the amnesia of all of the terrible events of history that are continuing to happen, and a desire to return to that like mundane comfort. And then you also, on the other side of the coin, found revolutionary possibility in the sense of, I didn't realize it was a Frederick Jameson quote of like being able to imagine the end of the world before the end of capitalism sort of thing. And so you're saying like, it's not no alternative. Yes, alternative to the things we're seeing now. And like, there were things in the 90s that were pushing for something new and wanting to reclaim that a bit. Am I right? Do I get an A?
A plus.
All right. Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, the first thing that you're talking about, on the one hand, right, is something we're really interested in about the 90s. The 90s as a kind of idea or fantasy structure, right? And it's not really about the history as it really was, right? But about what this kind of cultural imagination unlocks. So one thing we were really noticing was in early COVID, and this is when our conversation kind of actively started, was this kind of retreat into, and actually Friends is a great example of this, right? Of this retreat into 90s cultural forms and this kind of sense of stasis and ahistorical experience, you know,
Cultural
present that the 90s offered, right? In the form of like reruns of sitcoms and music and all sorts of things. And some of that is nostalgia, but it was also a nostalgia that we were really observing happening again for people who hadn't been in the 90s. We're really interested in that particular kind of nostalgia. And so that was that was one kernel that I wanted to just pick up on. Sean, do you want to
just sort of this desire to inhabit a sort of imaginary or kind of ideological space in which one is able to, with relative success or even ease, kind of disavow historical reality, right? In a moment where that seemed impossible because history was pressing in from all angles, the desire not to simply escape the present, but inhabit a historical moment in which was defined by ahistoricity, right? Defined by the sense that history was over, that history was not occurring, right? That history itself was a thing of the past. That seemed to us particularly interesting, and not simply about wanting to kind of like bury your head in the sand. It was like wanting to kind of rediscover the possibility of being able to do that with some degree of like coherence and consistency across an entire cultural and historical space. And then that became like one of the defining features of the 90s for us, was like not just that, you know, the history was declared to have ended, but rather that like it was somehow possible for many people to kind of like inhabit, not everyone. And obviously the other side of this question is like who could do this and who couldn't and why, but like despite all the atrocities of the decade, people narrate this moment as one of optimism, possibility, because particularly those who remember it as such, right? You know, you've got cultural figures from the 90s who are like, you know, back then we were bored, but now it looks great, you know? And that's that was something that we were just totally like sort of interested in thinking through. Found really bizarre, you know?
Does this give you a sense of like how people are going to narrate this time? Like when people periodize, what are we even in? I guess we're in the
2020s.
We are in the 20s. I thought we were in the teens for a second there, but like,
wow, okay.
Yeah.
Welcome back.
Thank you. when people periodize the 20s, what do you think the narrative, what are the options you see for what people, how people will tell these stories?
Well, this is something we were thinking about with the 90s a lot, is the experience of, especially as geriatric millennials. My dad is a boomer. My mom is not. My mom's cusp Gen X or whatever. But listening to all these stories of my dad recount, you know, anti-war protests and things like that as a child, my thought of, we thought a lot about this, the 90s were really the post-60s in a lot of ways. Feeling that postness, right? Feeling like, oh, we're not going to have a moment like that. It's not exciting. And I always kind of wondered about that. Then 2008 rolls around, and then I'm involved in a student movement, and things are feeling really spicy. We're occupying buildings and things like that. And I remembered thinking a lot about how, oh, this is how that must have felt. So I think about that experience a lot when I'm thinking about what's going on right now. I mean, we're seeing a lot of things that are just coming out of nowhere and getting weirdly used to that. And that's something I remember my elders describing of the 60s, is just kind of getting used to the shock. Wait, what's the next thing that's going to happen that's just going to throw everything in a new direction? I think that that's going to be part of it. But then there's this other aspect, which is, I think, this longing for mundanity and boredom and the feeling of being in the slop, like that. I also feel like it's very distinct to our moment. Those seem to be kind of the tensions.
Yeah, I mean, this comes back to the other side of the sort of like tension that you were describing earlier, that you kind of encountered in the introduction. Madeline began to speak about one side of it, which is the kind of political energies of that decade and trying to kind of recover them or return to them, or think about the ways in which they've kind of both been occluded but also kind of had returned on their own terms. And I think a lot about that cycle from 2008 to maybe like George Floyd, right? Mm-hmm. And in between there, you know, a bunch of different things happening, Occupy, but also things like Bernie Sanders or whatever, right? And the kind of, I think the 2020s will be compared to the long 2010s. And the 2010s will look like the decade or long decade of the millennial left, or the, you know, whatever you want to call it, right? And the 2020s will look like, well, I mean, we're 6 years in, you know, it feels like in some ways a retreat from that moment, or like a kind of loss, defeat, reaction. Not to say there wasn't loads of reaction in that decade, but like, yeah. So I don't know. I feel like the 2020, it's too, the problem is like we're in it, right? You're like,
yeah,
of course
we're in the whale, man. You can't, you know, you can't describe the whale from inside the belly so well, but the 2010s, I feel like, have a distinct character now already, and they are tied to a continuity with the revolutionary politics of the 90s. That's the claim I want to make about the 2010s.
Yeah. Okay.
I like that. Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about this specifically in terms of Me Too. I'm remembering there are a few points in the late 2010s where I was in these like meetings with older feminists, and they were like, wait for the pendulum to swing back. Like they're obsessed with backlash. Like that this is the only way that time and politics work, right? And like warning all the younger people, like, this is going to happen. Prepare for the backlash. This is coming for you within 2 years. And it's interesting to look back, because it's now almost 10 years. The pendulum has, I mean, I don't like that metaphor, but like, yeah, there have been several moments of backlash. And I've been thinking a lot about that specifically, that there's such a reaction against that moment taking place right now.
I've been trying to understand how to think about this. I forget who it's attributed to. It's probably one of those quotes where it's like, maybe no one, because it's like, did Gandhi say it? Did Martin Luther King say it?
Oh,
you know, whatever. The sort of the arc of the universe quote, the long arc of the universe bending toward justice. Or long arc of the moral universe bending toward justice, you know. And I saw someone bring that up to Michelle Obama, in from an interview.
Confession.
Right. And like her basically just affirming the quote as you would expect her to do. But how do both of you think about this idea of just taking the pendulum metaphor, however imperfect it is, of going of kind of the lash and the backlash and the one thing and the other thing? How, not that I expect you to have an answer to this, but like, how do we make progress if it's always just like, well, some people want the world to be better for everyone, some people don't, and it's always going to kind of be that way. But maybe generally, if we think of it from a Gandhi perspective, there'll be marginally less slavery in 100 years. You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. Like, it, how do we think about progress in a radical way that isn't, that doesn't get stuck in those liberal flattening of that back and forth?
Wow.
Yeah, of just needing like representation or tokenism to like affirm that progress has been made or something.
Right.
Is that what you mean?
I mean, we quote Benny Mean right in the intro because we're kind of interested in this question in the context of 90s discourse. You know, where like progress is just the piling up of wreckage upon wreckage.
Right.
That's what progress is. Is like, rather than try to like take the term and kind of rescue it from its liberal, whatever, just say what it is, right? Which is disaster. It just has a, it has a name that suggests otherwise, but its true content is catastrophe. I mean, the pendulum metaphor is a good, it's a better one than linearity. To quote Sharma's chapter title, right? It's not linear. Time doesn't, you know, political time in particular just simply doesn't take that form. As much as it might be comforting to think so. The pendulum gets us away from linearity. It gets us at least to the kind of image or model of the cycle. But then, of course, the kind of simple swing back and forth, as Madeline already kind of suggested, is maybe a little bit unsatisfactory as well, right? Dissatisfying in some way. We maybe want something again to like introduce an additional degree of nuance. I don't know. Some people like the figure of the spiral. There are various ways of thinking about historical movement.
I like waves. Waves are
waves,
good.
Waves.
When you're thinking about waves, they come onto the beach. What happens to the beach each time? You know? The beach remains, but it's reconfigured by the waves. I don't know. And then they go back.
And eventually, maybe if the weather is bad enough, the beach doesn't remain.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? In the town where I grew up, the beach is almost gone.
Oh,
from
wow.
really bad planning decisions made by like the beach people, the board that wants to draw people to the beach to buy ice cream and hang out, you know? And they put in a breakwater, which redirected current, and it's absolutely totally destroyed it. But yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. Okay.
You know, you can really run with this metaphor. But
I think we can. I think I'm sold on this. No, but with it is interesting when we're thinking about the Me Too thing. What I take back from it, some of these elders were saying, don't do this stuff because you're going to get hurt. Right, which is what I really resisted at the time.
Don't
I was like, no, this is the righteous thing.
Right, don't lean into.
Don't do
Me
this
Too.
Feminist organizing.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't yet Me Too, but you know, don't
sure.
Don't pursue these things. It's gonna bite you in the ass, you know. And like maybe the moment right now feels like the right opportunity, but those moments change, and you'll face repercussions. And she was. There are a couple of people in this, but they're kind of like really loudly speaking from that perspective. But there is something, I think back on that conversation a lot of like, well, what else could I have taken from that other than this direct advice to like not do something, right? And it was really just like expect recuperation, like expect retaliation, like do everything knowing that that will come, you know. Don't be surprised by that. Be prepared for those things, right?
Right.
I guess that's like a more generous reading. And So we see that like things get reconfigured and they get recuperated, like Me Too got recuperated by workplaces and institutions that hardly made a mark on private domestic violence or things like that, right? The shock got absorbed, you know, but there's something to learn from these moments where things go in total disarray, I guess, you know.
Thinking about the beach, would you say it's changed the terrain of struggle?
I think it has, yeah. I think back on that moment, and there are all these folks on the left who are suddenly like anti-woke, and then, you know, some of them are downright fascists now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's changed the composition of who we're struggling with, for sure. But I think, yeah, the level of strategy, certainly. I mean, I think the big mistake with Me Too was that it wasn't, I say that it only impacted workplaces, but that was the power of Me Too. If it had focused and become an actual kind of movement focused on the workplace, on workplace struggles, that might have been a more kind of substantive direction it could have taken than what happened.
Just thinking about work produced by some of my students, you know, mm-hmm. I had a student write a dissertation on adaptations of Lolita this year, which was really, really smart. I think, and kind of like motivated by the Me Too movement. And so, like, you know, people younger than me are inheriting the kind of successes and failures of this movement and this moment, and kind of working with it in new ways. So I mm-hmm. you know, they're both kind of operating on that changed terrain and also changing the terrain themselves, you know, within that context. So I think there's also like the question of, I don't know, maybe legacy is the wrong word, but like kind of intergenerational influence, right? That's ongoing and continuous, and that mm-hmm. seems to defy the kind of narrative arc that sometimes presents itself when we think about our own involvement with things, right? And certainly that's true for my relationship to some of those cycles of struggle in the post 2008 moment. You know, the Economist, I think, has published its like, you know, hit piece on Gen Z socialism, and you know, they did one on millennial socialism a decade ago, mm-hmm. right? And so mm-hmm. like there's a continuity there across generations, and and people in power are spooked by that, and that's good.
Oh yeah, Gen Z's problem is the rotisserie chickens that they're buying. That's the new—
Oh, is that their avocado toast?
That's the new issue. Yeah.
Wow.
That's what I don't know if it was the Economist who said that, but that's a recent allegation.
That's amazing. And even just like—
That is the smartest thing for a young person to buy. Dude, a rotisserie chicken?
Talk like, about honestly. A recession yeah. indicator too. They're not yes. going like avocado. They're not going like I fancy know. Veggie and carbs. They're going protein. They're going like protein. Basic, simple. That is the I most mean, like apocalyptic avocado toast.
They're
going to
make a soup from that. Yeah, that right. will last for 10 days.
It's also a reflection of, I don't know, protein hegemony or whatever the
whatever
is going on with protein. You can buy at Starbucks. You can get protein cold foam.
I know.
What the fuck is that? Like that's insane.
I just I don't know what any of those why things are. I couldn't get my protein in a cold foam for so long, and they solved a problem that I was really looking.
Are Gen Z like less inclined to be vegetarians? Is that part of it?
I don't think that's coming from Gen Z. I don't think the protein stuff is coming from— I think it's coming towards
no, it's
them.
Not. It's, not.
The it's coming from millennials,
chicken.
I think.
Yeah, yeah, right, okay.
I see. I don't know anything about that. I recently went back to being vegetarian. I was a vegan for a really long time, for 16 years. Mm-hmm. There's something in the moment where I was like, I'm going to go back. That also kind of felt like 90s.
So back being like—
I became a vegetarian in the 90s, in 1995. Mm-hmm. It was the year of Babe. I think Gordy came out the next year. I had read a book in which a boy has a pet pig, and they're on a farm, and they're like starving on the farm, and in the end they have to eat the pig.
Oh, no.
The family eats the pig. Right. And I read that, and I became a vegetarian when I was 10.
Okay. I mean, I also became a vegetarian in relationship to the 90s. So it was like in the wake of the long 90s. It was right after 2000, like after 2001 and then the war on terror and stuff. And I was reading like tons of like Noam Chomsky, and I read like Negri's Empire. But I was also reading all this stuff about like deep ecology and like factory farming. And I read this absolutely bonkers book called Diet for a New America, which starts out really intelligent and then is like, you're eating the nightmares of pigs and this is why you have nightmares.
Oh my god.
Yo, like, that is fucking metal as hell, dude. That is a fucking
that's wild
metal lyric for sure. Consuming
were you ever a vegetarian, Dave? Did you ever do that?
I had a couple of periods of it. I forget what sparked it initially, but my most memorable turn into vegetarianism was a like more of a personal atonement. There was I drove from my cousin's wedding on New Year's back to Chicago where I was living at the time, and they had this mashed potato bar, and I think the bacon bits made me sick, and I had, I think the only time I've ever had food poisoning, despite the amount of times I've used it as an excuse to skip work. The only time I've actually had food poisoning, the 5.5-hour drive from Columbus, Ohio to Chicago took me like 10 hours because I kept pulling over and puking. Puking. And then I was listening to music really loud, and this is early, early January, and I was feeling a little better, and the road was so icy. The highway was so icy. I was listening to this music super loud, and I spun out and did a 180 facing oncoming traffic and just happened to have a buffer of space in front of me and before that I was able to turn around, but I was like so terrified. And so my penance,
that's really scary.
I was like, this was related to this. I'm going to become a vegetarian, but I'm going to become, this was right as I was getting into baseball. So the thing I invented was ballpark vegetarianism, where I did not eat meat except I could have hot dogs at baseball games.
Okay.
Ballpark, Frank. Yeah. And I want to ask, is there even meat in bacon bits?
Bacon bits is vegan. I think it's vegetarian, just, at least.
Yeah, pure food poisoning.
I remember learning that. I mean, you said potato bar.
It was, it was rough.
Whoa. Potato bar?
It was, you know, the chives are out.
Oh boy.
The shredded cheese.
It might not have been the
out.
Bacon bits at all.
I know.
What if it was salmonella?
Sour cream.
I mean, whatever it was, it put the fear of God into me. And I think that's why, like, this is also a good bridge to, and we've already been doing it, the bridge to like the personal struggle, right? And because you guys are talking about these cultural forces. Sean, we did this on your episode, is take that cultural stuff and try to shoehorn it into personal growth narratives. And it is interesting.
I'm sure it was really streamless how you did it, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. I hope so. The idea of periodizing is so helpful. I mean, it literally, like, Sean, your episode is out, and in the show notes, I literally just quote from the Wikipedia definition of periodization. I should pull it up because it is like, I was like, this is what I'm doing with this show. Is just periodizing our lives, you know, thinking of them in terms of, the process or study of categorizing the past into discrete, quantified, and named blocks of time for the purpose of study or analysis. As corny as it is to do the, like, Webster's Dictionary defines blah, blah, blah as, it, like, you go to a definition sometimes and you're like, yeah, there's a reason. The definition really is a pretty succinct way of defining something.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's a good place to start. And our intro is kind of, we were both really impacted a long time ago by Frederick Jameson's work more broadly, but specifically this essay he wrote called Periodizing the 60s. And what I really learned from that, and that was written in 84, and kind of suggests that this thing, the long 60s, is like, you know, has arrived at this moment of articulation. And that that actually has to do with the present moment, right? Like what's going on in the mid 80s, right? And so, so that's a lot of what we're speaking of, like the 90s, how much we understood the 90s in relation to the end of the 60s, right? So we're really interested in like how these periods relate to each other, are defined by each other, they're porous and messy, they're not like strictly bound by decades, but also how inherently, like when we periodize, what we're really doing always is thinking about our own historical situation and what's revealed to us from that vantage, right? So I think
because it's all
those
like
are the things we're really interested in.
Like they, like you were saying.
Yeah, it is. We're talking about fantasies, a kind of like categories of the historical imagination, along with all of these things. But you talk to somebody and you say, like, what we all kind of have these things. I mean, when I think of the 70s, there's a particular color that comes to mind. When there's the 80s, another color scheme or a set of textures or fabric, right? We have this kind of like tangible, tactile relationships to periods, right? And so that is part of what we're working with, and acknowledging that that's a thing we kind of collectively culturally share, right?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it is made up. Periods are arbitrary in some ways, particularly decade based periodizations, right? And yet, you know, like Jameson also says, you can't not periodize. There are some people out there, cultural critics, who will argue vehemently against periodization as an intellectual project or as like a kind of useful tool for thinking about the cultural history or whatever. But it does seem to me that Jameson is right that it's relatively inescapable. And at the very least, it's culturally dominant way, which is not to say that that's necessarily a good reason to reproduce it, but you need, you know, to work with and in conversation with the world you live in, means kind of taking seriously people's predispositions. And, you know, it strikes me that like periodization is one of those kind of conceptual tools that gives us a kind of grasp on like something that is otherwise just a total mess. And, you know, even with the nuanced periodizing categories that we prefer in the book, which, you know, play with a mix up of time scales and so on, they still give us clarity and they still provide a degree of coherence, some of which is obviously a kind of product of the categorization itself, but that then allows us to work with the contents of it in fresh and interesting ways. And then also always kind of trying to think self-critically about the limits of that gesture at the same time.
It strikes me as the,
you know, what escapes the periodization.
Right. It strikes me as the kind of thing that can be, it's best used with a light touch. Is like, this is a tool to try on. How does, because the, you know, the personal aspect for me comes in where I'm thinking like, okay, if This Is Your Afterlife is a project of periodization, what does it mean to periodize? For me, the big one, right? Like, oh, my coma recovery. What year was that? How am I still in it? You know, and the thing that's compelling about the Return of the 90s book is it's like, A, the 90s is still happening, and B, it never happened. And that's both. And you can just like, and so it's not that any of these things is like the one truth as much as like a helpful, I'm going to say lens, don't hate me, Madeline, but a helpful lens through which to like interpret events, interpret a life that you can then use that right now. Like how does that, you know, and with life, like, so my childhood, because of events like that have happened with my family in the last couple of years, I've kind of rethought a bunch of my childhood. And I think a lot of us go through that where it's like, wait, is my family not like the thing that I thought my family was? And I don't have a like definitive answer as to what those things are, but it does inform how I move in the moment. And so I guess that answers what was the root of my question before about like progress. The root of that question was basically like, why struggle? If we know that the 1930s American South was super fucking radical when it comes to labor organization, and that it still got put down, you know, if we come up with another decade like that, is it just going to get put down? And I think the answer, at least the answer I'm talking myself to, is like, well, we are in the present, and how are you using all of these things as all these interpretive apparati as like ways to inform how you're moving through the present? And so I guess I'm wondering for you to, either in your work or in your life, how has this project or the project of periodizing in general changed how you, how has either periodizing the 90s changed your work in your life, or how has the project of periodizing in general changed, and how does it continue to change your work and your life?
Well, I want to say one thing to the question about why struggle, which is,
do you have an answer?
Have you guys seen Andor?
Yes.
So all the other Star Wars spinoffs are shit, but this fucking show is so good.
It's good. Yeah.
And one of the things it's really good on is that things you do will contribute to a project of anti-fascist liberation in ways that you cannot foresee, and that may not occur for decades or even longer. It reminds me of like medieval craftsmen building fucking castles or whatever under shitty conditions, but nevertheless, like knowing they will never see the finished product. It takes multiple generations, but just kind of being, not needing to kind of like, not to, to like fixate on like tangible results that one can enjoy the benefits of, right? But rather this kind of sense that like, there's a kind, not to like turn the struggle into some metaphysical transhistorical thing that's been going on forever. I know that there's good Marxist traditions on that front, but they're not mine. But anyway, you know, there is something really valuable in thinking about struggle beyond the level of the individual or social consciousness in a kind of given historical moment. But what I want to say about periodization is that the work on periodization that has been most useful for me is for thinking, has been about thinking about the way the periodization is kind of just out there in the world. And I don't just mean that it's like a cultural disposition that people tend to kind of practice kind of at the level of common sense, but that like the structures of our social world at a kind of level of objectivity produce periods as a kind of feature of their movement through time. And so this in a way kind of moots the whole debate about periodization for me. And so trying to kind of like,
in what way does clear, it mute it?
Because it's kind of irrelevant. Like, it's not about whether one is for or against periodization as an intellectual project, because to my mind, periodization is a kind of effect of the movement of history, right? That one has to kind of like reckon with for
it's
all
a
it's
reckoning.
Kind of, yeah.
Doesn't matter if you believe in it, it believes in you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
A little bit.
It's a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. It's working on you. Reckoning is obviously an important term for us in the book. So thinking about how I can understand my life within like broader cycles, spirals, and waves through categories of periodization has really helped both like think clearly about my own historical moment and my relationship to it, but also a much bigger picture that deprioritizes my own experience of historical time a little bit, right? And allows me to think on levels that are far in excess of that in ways that I find liberating and exciting.
I think all I would add to that is I try not to think about, there are, I mean, we're living in a capitalist world where things are appreciably getting worse and worse. And I don't mean to deny that. But there's a lot of things historically, politically, that take place that can't really be measured on this metrics or of like making the world better or worse. And some of that is for these reasons, like you put something out into the world and maybe you don't even get to be the person who finds out the impact of that, you know? But I think that's a lot of, I try to draw from periodization or any of these other kinds of historical methods, like just ways of thinking about how history is experienced, historicity, right? Like, how does time operate? How does that feel? I hate to say this, like, how does that feel in the body? But like, what's the kind of sensory experience of history and these kinds of things? Like, what are the things I can be looking for? And to just not assume, to assume, if anything, that like history will surprise and rattle you and things like that. But I don't know. I just watched Reds the other day. My kid was sick and we were like, let's watch a 3.5-hour movie. So we watched Reds. And I hadn't seen it in a long time, but something I really liked about the movie watching it was just kind of feel like following these characters and the decisions that they make to, you know, go across the country, go into exile, these like what they're paying attention to that motivates them to make these drastic decisions about their lives at such a young age. I was really struck by that. I mean, they're thinking about like very real domestic, like logistical, practical impacts too of that kind of life of being committed to the revolution in some way. And I don't know. I think it was interesting. It's things that you're looking for in the present moment. You know, we talk about like the political climate or things like that. But I think for me, it's like a way of reading the present, reading experience, making sense of it, situating in it in something and much longer and deeper that is beyond me. And yeah, maybe that sounds very metaphysical, but
well,
just thinking kind of experientially, like what? So. Yeah, exactly. But I think when I discovered this stuff, that's really what it gave me. And it's not surprising that was, for me, that was in, I read Periodizing the 60s in 2008, you know, the moment of being politicized by the financial crisis and all of these things completely aligned. It gave me a really different way of thinking about my own place in history.
Yeah.
But
it's, I'm realizing that the sort of humbling effect that both of you are describing is something that I've gotten from doing this show and asking people what they hope happens when they die and have them not just answer in terms of an afterlife, which I do want to appreciate, Sean, how much yours revolved around sleep.
I'm excited to hear that.
But also people talking about what they wanted the world after them to what they had hopes for there. And that just reframed my experience to be less about the panic of the question of the unknown and more about, just the project in the moment of moving through the world and the possible effects that could have.
Mm-hmm.
Two more questions.
Okay.
One is, how would you two periodize the period of writing Return of the 90s? What is this time in your life mean for you? And how is that, like, Sean, we talked about it a little bit, I guess, actually, in terms of kind of connecting the dots that this was the first project that you dove into after your mom died. How do you think you will remember the time of writing this book?
I mean, this project, I suppose, this is going to sound sentimental and wishy-washy and whatever else, but it kind of was like, yeah, I don't know. It was like a return to the world for me from a period of intense kind of like, it wasn't that my world was diminished by the experiences of that previous period, which, you know, you and I discussed at length, right? In that episode, when I was home looking after my mom after my dad died and then her death and stuff, but that my world was radically different. And while it did shrink to, you know, to that space and time, but within that space and time, it was very rich and full of good and bad things. But yeah, I think returning to the rest of the world, and this of course coincides a bit with the kind of like an experience that everybody had, I think, many people had in that moment, which was the closing down of worlds during COVID and lockdowns, and then the return to the world, so to speak, afterwards. Mm-hmm. I just had a different inflection on that experience, right? And so this project was a way to kind of like re-enter, yeah, broader things, right? My interests, my social circles, you know, my political connections and so on. And so then the project has been for me about kind of like expanding those fronts and adding details to them again.
Hmm.
What about you, Madeline?
That's one way of thinking about it. There's a lot more to say, but that's one way of thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. We had this kind of anxiety knowing how the temporality of book publications work. Mm-hmm. Where we're like, when this comes out, will the return of the 90s be over? And some of how we framed the introduction was thinking about that too, right? We're really thinking about describing the present, but thinking about the early 2020s. That became more clear to us along the way. I went through a lot of stuff. So this was the end of my 30s. Was doing this project with Sean. I moved across the state in this time. I published 2 books in this time. Because it's been a long process. And it had to be because of having so many contributors and things like that. It's kind of unwieldy in the best possible way. So I think I made a lot of transitions out of my life living in the Bay Area. And now I'm in Portland, so I kind of think about that geographic move that's happening in the background of this book. Mm. But yeah, this time has been, moving to Portland especially has been like rerooting myself somewhere. I really like living here and I really don't want to leave, which is a nice feeling to have. I don't feel like I've ever actually lived somewhere and felt that way. But having much of the time we were writing this, I had left the place where all my friends were and my life had been and things like that, and was trying to kind of reestablish myself. And so I think having a project like this, and, you know, I think I've talked about this with both of you, but having these like epistolary long distance relationship with lots of collaborators really buoys me. And so I was just kind of figuring those things out about myself. And I think that working with somebody else collaborating, it really reveals a lot to you if you're willing to look at yourself. Like, what are my habits? What are the limits of my thinking? What can I learn from my collaborator? But also like, what am I failing at? So I think I was doing a lot of that kind of reflection in this time too. I don't know. That was more of a like psychological answer.
No, there's no wrong answer. That's great.
Okay. That's good.
This has obviously not been the like, you know, traditional format of the podcast to the extent that I've held on to that at all in the last few months. But my last tentpole question of folks is to describe a memory. The framework for this memory, I have asked both of you to present your most 90s memory. And true to the book, that does not have to be a memory literally from the 1990s. And it is ultimately up to you to determine what that means.
Can I give two memories?
Of course.
One's really quick.
Yeah.
All right, I'm ready. Are you ready, Sean?
Yeah.
Do you want to go first or second?
Why don't, Madeline, you mind. Give one, then Sean gives
one. Okay, I'll sandwich. One,
and you give sandwich. Your, yeah.
Okay, well, one very 90s coded memory I have of adolescence is I started smoking very early, definitely in elementary school. And then by middle school, I was smoking, you know, always had a pack on me because my grandma, she filled her vegetable crisper drawer in the refrigerator, not with vegetables, of course, but cartons and cartons of cigarettes. And she smoked so much that she just never noticed when I would steal some. So I have all of these memories of, you know, being in diners when I'm like 11, 12 with my other 6th, 7th, 8th grade friends. I mean, later on too, but starting at that age, going into the smoking section, just drinking black coffee and smoking a lot. And later on, we discovered cigars, and we would also do that in the smoking section of diners. The smoking section of diners, right? That's so 90s. Don't you kind of miss it? I do. I miss it.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
I'm just imagining days as a server serving a like 11 or 12 year old smoking a cigar and what I think of this kid. I'm like,
I was like 14, 15 when the cigars came.
Okay.
But there are other booths with kids though. And that was just kind of,
No, you know, of course. It's just, yeah,
was
I
like
wonder
what it was like to be a young person. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I also remember downtown. Smoking
you
in
were
like convenience stores that had seating areas, right? Where you could drink really weird coffee into it's not like my most 90s memory, but it is like a formative 90s memory, and I'll explain what I mean by that. So I was, I think, probably 12. I was with a few of my friends, sort of childhood friends, some of whom would kind of like continue to be friends beyond this moment and others wouldn't. This is a real kind of rupture moment. And we had this skateboard, which is like a real piece of shit, sort of, I don't know.
A shared skateboard?
Yeah, we only had one.
That's awesome.
And it was like, this is the 90s, so people are riding like what were then like modern decks with a nose and a tail, kind of like, we had like an 80s deck with like a fat tail, narrow nose, trying to learn how to ollie on. It was so heavy, had massive wheels. Just a nightmare, really. But we took it. We like wandered from our like. I lived close to the center of town, and in the 90s, my small town was absolutely packed with kids on Friday and Saturday night, like dozens, maybe even 100, in different groups based on what neighborhood they were from, interacting, partying like mad. It was super, super exciting. I felt like I lived in a metropolis. Yeah. It was bonkers, and we wandered into it and came upon this scene. Where a guy who I would later sort of see as this kind of like icon legend, he was like way older. I'm like, of like kind of a particular kind of subculture, is on top of a police car screaming, "I am the walrus."
Hey, talk about periodizing the 60s, the long 60s.
Well, I was just going to say, like, right, the post 60s, here it is. And I'm like, completely in awe of this scene that's like unfolding in front of me. There's kids everywhere, and like this group, then he gets arrested kind of violently, and then
so
I'm also introduced to like police and the policing of youth culture, violent policing of youth culture, and the kind of like anti-police sentiment of this group of people. And this other members of this group of skateboarders, really, they kind of come over and they're like making fun of the board that we have, and they're dressed really cool. And like, this is this moment where I kind of enter into this kind of bigger world. And because of things like globalization, I'm very quickly buying like Thrasher magazine. I'm starting to listen to like New York rap music. I'm starting to listen to like what we then called new school punk, although that term would mean something radically different to people nowadays. And this is associated with the 2010s, but really for us meant shit off Fat Records or like Burning Heart in Sweden or whatever. And like smoking and like doing all kinds of other nefarious shit and like getting into politics and starting to listen to like G7 Welcoming Committee bands coming out of Winnipeg, producing stuff about, you know, different forms of economy and anarchism and critiques of the state. And so like for me, like the 90s, it's political and cultural content kind of opens up in front of me, blossoms as a result of kind of wandering into the scene where a guy was standing, jumping up and down on top of a cop car, screaming, "I'm the Wallace."
That's amazing.
That's such
how
like...
old do you think you were then?
Oh, yeah.
Hey,
how old were you?
12.
12. Okay. Okay.
That's such a beginning of a movie freeze frame. I bet you're wondering why how I yes. got here. Sort of.
Yes, I know.
Montage. Yeah, that's great.
Absolutely.
Okay, Madeline, what's the end of the sandwich here?
Well, are you going to tell one too, Dave?
No, I'm the host.
I want to hear yours.
Oh,
but
fuck.
Okay,
yeah, I literally, okay, you tell one and right, I'll try to split my brain and be engaged think of one at the same time.
This is a very geeky one. Okay. So in 1998, the American Film Institute released its top 100 American films list, okay? Which was a big deal at my local Blockbuster, which I would go to multiple times a week. It was like a half mile from my dad's house. And I'm 12 when this comes out. I start going there and I get the list and I'm like, I'm going to watch every fucking one of these movies. And they didn't have all of them, but I watched every single one that they had. That includes Midnight Cowboy, Clockwork Orange, like pretty weird stuff. And they were like making sure with my dad that it was okay. My dad was very accommodating, very cool. Anyways, after I watched every single one of them, they wrote to the AFI, one of the like college students working at Blockbuster, who thought I was like such a cool 12-year-old.
Okay.
Wrote to Blockbuster or wrote to AFI, and the AFI gave me an honorary membership.
Whoa.
So I got to, and it was like, I think 5 years. So I got to vote on stuff and all sorts of things. And it was, they sent me something in the mail, like, and explained this. And it was like from a specific person at the AFI, which also feels so 90s, right? Like that somebody's like opening the letters and like coming up and then making this thing and sending it to me.
How long did the membership last? Isn't that amazing?
I think 5 years. It went into almost through high school.
Wow.
But it was very cool. I mean, it didn't really mean that much other than I got stuff in the mail and things like that.
Yeah. Did you get squeezed?
Do you still it was have cool. any of them?
No.
Okay.
No, but that was cool. And then, but I remember it was very difficult that Blockbuster had many of the titles, but then I had to start going out and finding other places to get the other titles, which led me to this like independent foreign video rental place and stuff like that. And so it kind of just, I don't know, really cemented. I was already very into films, but it was just, that was a very before after moment, you know, where it was like, okay, I'm a film person now. I'm watching these things. This is a part of my, 12-year-old identity. And I'm going to make these relationships with these like weird college students working at the video stores. And like, that's part of my like social endeavor as a teenager.
That is very 90s.
That's awesome.
Very
it 90s. Was 90s, yeah. So I felt I needed to explain.
So you're
that.
Just
okay, Dave. Do you have one?
Yeah, I do. But you just got your legs kicked back up on your desk, smoking your cigar, voting on what the next top 100 American horror movies is going to be at age 14.
Yep, that's me.
That's awesome.
That was my life.
Okay.
Now
well,
I wish that would have been cooler.
Mine is also, you know, it's kind of a mishmash, but it definitely involves. Riding in our family van, which was the, you know, mid-90s Dodge Caravan, baby blue with the wood paneling. And so
classic.
That, we would have that. And it's really a memory of like that car and grocery stores. And so it's kind of, I'm going to combine a couple of things. So it's one is like being in that car and asking my parents, I'd seen, there was something about going to stores with my family, which is very like liminal, I think, as overused as that is as a concept at the moment. But like the seeing the tabloids at the checkout.
Yes, I was going to ask you about the tabloids.
Well, and so the one I remember somehow asking my parents, and this is, you know, evangelical Christian family in Oklahoma at the time. And so asking them what the deal was with Magic Johnson having AIDS. And I was like, what is it? And I don't remember. I don't remember if they said it's it, and it's that vagueness that sticks out to me as like I both somehow, and maybe this is just the vagaries of memory and I'm like projecting back, but like I remember having the sense that it was sexual, that it was promiscuous, and that it was also gay somehow. That there was like an intimation that, like, you know, and maybe he's gay because it's, you know, HIV, AIDS. I guess it was just HIV. But yeah. And so there's that. And then there's also just sitting in the parking lot and waiting in the car in the parking lot while my parents did shopping. And my brother and sister and I would play a game where I would lean on the back bench of the car that like, you don't call it the, I guess it's the trunk of the van, but it's not separate. It's just like, you know, there's the back bench and then the back of the car. So I would put my chest down on the bench, like over like bent over the bench, like looking down into the quote trunk of the van. Then my brother would lie on top of me, facing down, and my sister would lie on top of him facing down. So we would have just like this stack of pancakes. And the game was just me flipping them over and landing on them in the back of the van. That's awesome. So just, yeah, that freedom and recklessness and weirdly, like, what a big world for such a small space that van was, that those grocery store end caps were. Yeah, but it's so funny to do these and then, like, realize the pull of nostalgia comes for all of us, you know, but it's like you can't escape being like, they were, the 90s really were just the greatest, you know.
Oh, I want to be a baby again. I want my mother. Exactly. of course, if only she could just nuzzle me and, you know, rock me to sleep. Right,
exactly.
There is that pull, of course. But yeah, I think the experience of being left alone in a car at the grocery store, along with being taken to the grocery store and like looking at these tabloids and being like, what? I think those are also very spot on geriatric millennial memories specifically.
Do you guys remember
Bat
Baby?
Baby. For sure.
I mean, I don't know anything. I just know vague pictures that I remember. I don't know anything about
same.
Bat
I can
Baby.
Picture the face of Bat Baby right now.
Yeah.
Beyond that, no. I mean, you know, I didn't read it, did I? But I definitely stared at it a lot.
Those tabloids, though. Those tabloids are—they're imprinted in my mind as well. And I just watched the Ryan Murphy thing about the '90s, the love story with the JFK Jr. Carolyn Bessette thing.
Okay.
I watched it. It was also on the treadmill. Callback.
Oh yeah.
One of the things that was happening to me while I was watching it was like, oh my God, I like know this exact fucking sweater and hat that, you know, where is it? And I looked up a couple of instances as I was watching it. I looked up and there were I was like, oh yeah, I totally remember this, whatever, National Enquirer issue with this photograph on the front page that must have just burned into my young memory, you know? But you're like, it is a hostage situation. You're spending like 10-15 minutes in line sometimes, and your parents are doing all of these things, and all you have to do is just stare at these pictures and ponder them, right?
The so other it was, pictures it was that a weird I stared at thing. Were the posters in the backs of not the grocery store, but like...
Were there boobs?
Yeah, of course. Like a music store, you know, like a Sam Goody at the mall. Just any like culture store like that. The back where they have the like... the metal stands with the posters that you flip through.
Oh, yeah.
And specifically, I remember a... And I mean, that was like such a site of sexual awakening for me. And and I would like go get, I would go somewhere else before I knew my parents would be like back there. And then I would, they were like, we were looking all over for you. I was like, yeah, I was just around, you know, like my pants tent is like growing as I'm talking. And there, but the one poster I remember so well was a woman, because it was the like there was the Got Milk campaign around that time, and she had milk mustache and a and she had a crop top that was showing under boob, and the and the poster said Got Cookies, and I was like, which and hot. And I'm like,
that's hot.
I don't. It was so. It was hot, dude. as a budding fat pervert, cookies and titties. You know? But yeah, I've never really heard people refer to tits as cookies. Now that I think about it, but for some reason, in that moment, I knew like both her tits are the cookies, and they've got milk in them too somehow. Like, just, I don't know, all just mixed up. That's so amazing. What are you guys going to do a chapter on that, on the Got Cookies poster?
Right. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But that's the show. Thank you both.
Thanks
for
having
on.
Us on.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for having fun. Us.
Sean, I made the mistake of saying that the book is out this week, but it is available for pre-order still. I think it comes out.
Yes.
What, next year? The 20th? June 20th, it looked like?
Yeah.
Do you know what, too?
What?
If you pre-ordered it, you may have gotten a tracking update saying your order has shipped. Yo. So I think...
Did you get
some
one,
some people's copy... No, but people I know have told me that they have gotten notifications saying their order has shipped. I've not heard anyone
somebody
say
in Portland received
it yet.
No, I saw one yesterday.
Really?
Somebody sent me a picture.
Nice.
They had one in their hand, and I was like, how come you have one and not me? This is wild. But
okay.
Pluto Press, we love you. No, no, no worries.
Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah, no, so no, the no. links to buy...
Shut up, Pluto Press.
Links to buy the book are in the show notes. And
I'm excited when I get the copies. It's going to be great.
Yeah, love you.
Buy Madeline's book, Solidarity with Children. Follow both of them. Is there anything else, though, that you want to tell people about of your
work? I've got two projects coming out soon.
Yeah.
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 Keywords for Value and Culture is coming out with Comparative Literature and Culture Online, CLC Web, like next week. It's a massive it's a special double special issue with 34 contributors. I'm finalizing the proofs right now. We're going to get a literally turnaround because it's online super fast and get it out. Please check that out. Co-edited with my friend and comrade Tom Waller.
And my nemesis.
Why? Because it's the other editor?
Yeah, he's your...
He's my
he's
other
the other man.
No,
I've never met him, but I've been making this joke now for like 6 months, so hopefully he knows.
Yeah, because there is a lot of
doesn't reach around to him.
That I've
been calling him my nemesis.
And then I've got another project coming out soon, which I edited on my own, weirdly, called Growing Pains, which is coming out with Textual Practice. Has a dozen really, really smart essays in it from a bunch of cool people. And that should be out. We're going to start releasing essays from that like one at a time before the full publication of the issue.
Nice.
So yeah, look out for that.
Hell yeah.
That's exciting.
What about you, Madeline? Mm.
Hell yeah. Yeah, just if you can buy my book, Solidarity with Children, An Essay Against Adult Supremacy, that came out in November from Haymarket. that's really what I'm promoting right now. I have a couple of things I'm trying to get going. I have next projects in mind. I have a collaboration, but I'm not able to announce any of those right now. So,
hush, hush.
All right. Ooh. Mysterious.
Well, thank you to everyone for listening to the show. Thanks to Matt Sage for the artwork, TIYA House Band Lake Mary for the music. Like I said, listeners like you are how the show keeps going, both financially at patreon.com/thisisyourafterlife. You get all the regular episodes plus the premium feed with episodes on the off weeks. And also this summer, the Tarkovsky filmography miniseries, which I did not have a name for when I recorded it, but by the time I had titled the episode and it came out, so you already know, listener, that the series is called Podcasting in Time. I am announcing it for the first time on the record here. So, but, and that's not on any schedule. That's a bonus for the bonuses. I'm going to be releasing stuff every week through the Patreon, and then just randomly over the course of the summer, there will be these Tarkovsky movie episodes, really, that I'm very excited about. You can find all of that at thisisyourafterlife.com and on Instagram. And also, you guys know this, but people who make stuff really survive on compliments in so many ways. So if you can't contribute financially, email me one nice thing to thisisyourafterlifepodcast@gmail.com. And yeah, until next time, remember, you are a mist.